Chapter 26 Swing Around the Circle. When the new Congress met in December 1865, it grew crystal clear to radical Republicans that Andrew Johnson's Reconstruction policies were slanted toward the entrenched white South. Southern states sent white representatives to Washington who reflected the old Confederacy, not a newly reconstituted region, leading radicals to take matters into their own hands. Congress set up a joint committee on Reconstruction, co-chaired by a moderate Republican senator, William Pitt Fessenden of Maine, and Representative Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, an ardent abolitionist. Johnson saw this as an attempt by the legislative branch to wrest away prerogatives that properly belonged to the executive. Radicals advanced the argument that Confederate states, by seceding, had relinquished their former rights as sovereign states and should be treated like territories, their terms of readmission defined by Congress. Guided by this perspective, they refused to seat new Southern congressmen or admit their states back into the Union. For all their excessive zeal, these militant Republicans would produce some of the most powerful legislation in American history to accord equal rights to African Americans. Instead of the bromides Grant had doled out about Southern harmony, the Joint Committee delved into violence inflicted on two particular groups. One was the so-called carpetbaggers, tens of thousands of young Northerners who flocked southward to earn money and aid freed people. They built schools and churches, bought plantations, and often risked their lives to assist blacks. In Southern mythology, they would be demonized as corrupt parasites, but many were motivated by idealism and paid a steep price for their courage. Southern whites who supported Reconstruction, called scalawags, faced similar antipathy. Carpetbagger harassment was tame compared to the outright terror inflicted on blacks. One former Louisiana slave testified that whites flogged blacks as if they were still enslaved, and that more than 2,000 had been killed around Shreveport in 1865 alone. Blacks enjoyed little recourse to local sheriffs, who were often Confederate veterans and seldom acted against whites charged with crimes against blacks. It grew patently obvious that Southern blacks could count on protection only from federal troops. As one Mississippi observer pleaded, "Take away garrisons from this southern county, and the Negroes will be subjected to every outrage." From Georgia came warnings of a new breed of nocturnal terror unleashed against blacks. General Rufus Saxton reported a black man killed by a band of disguised men at midnight, a grisly scene reenacted many times in coming years. As southern blacks came to rely on the U.S. military for protection, Grant was thrust smack into the middle of the controversy. A man of fixed purpose, he never faltered in his deep concern for the fair treatment of freed people. On January 12, 1866, he took aim at anti-black discrimination when he issued General Orders No. 3, which protected colored persons from prosecutions in any southern state charged with offenses for which white persons are not prosecuted or punished in the same manner and degree. Supplied with copious and quite graphic reports by Southern commanders, Grant soon realized that the hopeful tenor of his December report had been a pipe dream. After dispatching Cyrus Comstock to New Orleans to confer with Generals Edward Canby and Phil Sheridan, he received a sobering report in late January. "Saw General Canby, who says feeling is worse now than at close of war. He and Sheridan both say Northern men could not stay South if martial law were revoked or troops withdrawn, as they could get no justice from courts. Canby says if troops were withdrawn, the Negroes would be far worse off than before the war, being no longer property to be cared for." On February 7th, President Johnson met at the White House with five black leaders, including Frederick Douglass, who came to lobby for a civil rights bill. The black leaders were treated in a tasteless, abusive manner. After they shook hands with the president, their spokesman, George T. Downing, said they hoped he would support voting rights for blacks, which elicited a bizarre, rambling monologue from Johnson. He admitted to having owned slaves, but boasted of never having sold one, as if that would somehow ingratiate him with his visitors. He presented himself as a kindly master who had been their slave instead of their being mine. To promote civil rights, Johnson went on, would result in the extermination of one race or the other. If given the vote, the colored man and his master combined would conspire to keep poor whites in slavery, denying them a portion of the rich land of the country. After the bewildered delegation filed out, Johnson boasted to his secretary, "Those damn sons of bitches thought they had me in a trap." Around this time, cracks appeared in the facade of unity between Grant and Johnson. In mid-February, Grant shut down the Richmond Examiner for stridently disloyal editorials, lifting the order only when the president protested. Nonetheless, Grant instructed Southern commanders that the persistent publication of articles calculated to keep up a hostility of feeling between the people of different sections of the country cannot be tolerated. He disputed a resolution of the Mississippi legislature demanding that federal troops be withdrawn, saying local authorities refused to execute the law and maintain order for blacks. He also plied the president with statistics showing that whites committed far more crimes against blacks than the reverse, 44 more murders and 78 more assaults. That February, Johnson's relations with congressional Republicans soured further when Johnson vetoed a bill to extend the Freedmen's Bureau. In his veto message, he cast scorn on the Bureau as an immense patronage scheme that only cosseted indolent blacks. In fact, the Bureau was poorly financed and chronically understaffed, never fielding more than 900 agents in the South. Under slavery, more than 90% of the adult black population had been illiterate, and the Bureau had performed superlative work in helping young evangelicals and Northern aid societies to teach them to read. The former slaves reacted with an unquenchable thirst for education. By early 1866, a Bureau official calculated that 500,000 of these poor people are now studying the spelling book or advanced readers. Outraged by the veto, radicals retaliated with a joint resolution stating that no senator or representative from former Confederate states should be readmitted until Congress decided they were entitled to representation, thus sharpening the battle lines with Johnson. On the night of February 22nd, Washington's birthday, a large throng of Johnson's supporters streamed to the White House to congratulate him on his veto message. The president exploited the occasion to rant against his foes in a wild-eyed, intemperate, egotistical manner, inveighing against radical Republicans and the Joint Committee on Reconstruction. George Templeton Strong thought the president was intoxicated with old bourbon on the occasion. He avowed himself at war with radicalism and denounced Sumner in the Senate and Stevens of the House and abolitionist Wendell Phillips as disunionists and traitors. He talked of senators going about with assassination in their hearts. This may result in an impeachment of the president within 30 days. It would take much longer to accomplish that goal, but the rabidly partisan speech polarized the Capitol in a way that foreshadowed that harrowing outcome. In early March, Grant applied to Johnson to have his 15-year-old son, Fred, admitted to West Point, and he was promptly accepted. Grant and longtime aide Theodore Bowers shepherded Fred to the academy for his entrance exams a few days later. Bowers was a 33-year-old bachelor and former newspaperman from Illinois, a handsome, bearded young man with dark, wavy hair and expressive eyes. The Grant family had delighted in his self-deprecating humor. On the way home, Grant boarded the train at Garrison Station, across the Hudson River from the academy, but Bowers, running late, tried to leap onto the train as it left the station. Unable to find a solid footing, he got trapped between the train and the platform and was dragged along, then fell to the tracks and was run over by one wheel, which mangled his face, severed his arms, and killed him on the spot. When Grant got off the train to see what had happened, the rails were streaked with blood, his friend's body twisted beyond recognition. Those with Grant admired his stoic calm as he drafted orders to dispose of the body. Crushed by the calamity, he told Sherman, "The loss of poor Bowers is one that I feel more keenly than it is usually possible for anyone to feel for another, not an immediate member of their own family." It was typical of Grant to respond profoundly to death with inner grief, but no outward show of emotion. After attending Bowers' funeral at West Point, Grant returned to a capital preoccupied with the civil rights bill introduced by radical Republicans to nullify black codes in the South that prevented freedmen from owning property, making contracts, and filing lawsuits. Though silent on voting rights, the bill sought to bring the full blessings of citizenship to anyone born in the United States, including blacks, protecting them by the full and equal benefit of all laws. Native Americans were excluded. This landmark legislation defined citizenship rights in a new manner that made the federal government, not the states, the guarantor of basic liberties. On March 27th, Andrew Johnson vetoed the bill, denouncing it for trespassing on states' rights. Instead of viewing it as a brave attempt to remedy historic injustice, he denigrated it for surpassing anything the federal government has ever provided for the white race. Perversely, he interpreted it as a case of reverse discrimination, made to operate in favor of the colored and against the white race. He heaped further insults on the black community by stating that immigrants had superior claims to American citizenship because they better understood the nature and character of our institutions. The veto was a reckless move by Johnson, the original bill having passed both houses by overwhelming margins. In a then unprecedented action, Congress dealt a resounding defeat to Johnson by overriding his veto. Johnson had damaged his standing, leading even moderate Republicans to distance themselves from him. "The feud between Johnson and the radicals grows more and more deadly every day," observed George Templeton Strong, "and threatens grave public mischief." Grant was caught in the dispute as both sides worked hard to lay claim to his incomparable prestige. Thinking it improper for Army officers to take public stands on legislation, Grant had kept a punctilious silence on the civil rights bill, but Johnson was bent on enlisting his support whether he liked it or not. When Grant threw a glittering soiree at 205 I Street, President Johnson ventured outside the White House to stand between Ulysses and Julia Grant on the receiving line, and radical Republicans were taken aback by his presence. Grant's team of commanders in the South enforced the new Civil Rights Act. General Daniel Sickles abolished South Carolina's Black Code, stating that all laws shall be applicable alike to all inhabitants, while General Alfred Terry barred Virginia's vagrancy law as an effort to restore slavery in all but its name. A backlash arose among white Southerners, producing stepped-up vigilante activity as robed, hooded figures beat and murdered blacks. White Northern teachers working with the Freedmen's Bureau faced death threats, and black schools and churches were burned with impunity in North Carolina, Mississippi, and Alabama. Grant continued to present Johnson with statistics documenting racially motivated violence against blacks and added two new categories of coercion: driving off blacks without compensation for labor and retaining freedmen without compensation. In early May, a vicious race riot in Memphis resulted in 48 blacks killed, 70 injured, and 5 black women raped in 3 days. On May 12th, Major General George Stoneman reported to Grant from Memphis that the unrest was touched off when white policemen arrested 2 boisterous black men and hauled them to the station house, whereupon black bystanders wounded a police officer with a pistol shot. In retaliation, police gathered a mob of white citizens, some outfitted in Confederate uniforms, and proceeded to shoot, beat, and threaten every Negro met with in that portion of the city. The next day, these white vigilantes set ablaze black schools, churches, and homes, one black witness alleging that white arsonists chanted calls for a white man's government as they spread mayhem. Thank heaven the white race are once more rulers of Memphis, the Memphis Avalanche editorialized with satisfaction. Grant impaneled a body to probe the Memphis riots. In reporting to Stanton, he showed that local authorities had tolerated a bloody vendetta by policemen and firemen against black citizens. What resulted was a scene of murder, arson, rape, and robbery in which the victims were all helpless and unresisting Negroes, stamping lasting disgrace upon the civil authorities that permitted them. Grant noted that the only protection afforded black citizens came from a small body of federal troops. He recommended that the riot instigators be held by the military until civil authorities in Memphis proved willing to prosecute them. Dispatching several cavalry companies, he gave them these pointed instructions. If the civil authorities fail to make arrests for past violence, let the troops make them and hold the parties in confinement until they, the civil authorities, give satisfactory evidence that justice will be done. In General Orders No. 44, he generalized this policy to all Southern states. A strict and prompt enforcement of this order is required, by command of Lieutenant General Grant. In the face of a recalcitrant president, Grant was rapidly emerging as the foremost protector of persecuted Southern blacks. He exhibited increasing militance in his view that only federal troops could provide safety for former slaves. On May 31st, the Missouri Democrat ran an interview with Grant that he thought was off the record. His voice differed markedly from the soothing tone of his December report and was the more striking because of it. Troops must be kept at all the principal points in the South for some time to come, he said. This will be necessary to repress the turbulence of a class of the South very dangerous to well-disposed persons, and also to protect the rights of the freedmen, who are looked upon with deep hatred by a large proportion of the people. He was incensed at the sudden defiance of Southerners he had thought chastened. A year ago they were willing to do anything. Now they regard themselves as masters of the situation. Then, most shockingly, Grant pitched into Robert E. Lee. Lee is behaving badly. He is conducting himself very differently from what I had reason, from what he said at the time of the surrender, to suppose he would. No man at the South is capable of exercising a tenth part of the influence for good that he is, but instead of using it, he is setting an example of forced acquiescence, so grudging and pernicious in its effect as to be hardly realized. Though he regretted his remarks were published, Grant never disavowed their authenticity. Grant's belief that only federal troops could give Southern blacks a feeling of security ran afoul of the conservative consensus hardening inside Johnson's cabinet. On July 13th, Attorney General Speed admitted to the president that the most disgusting scenes of murder, arson, rape, and robbery had been practiced in Memphis against helpless and unresisting colored citizens. But he forswore federal responsibility, wrapping himself in the righteous rhetoric of states' rights. He conceded that Grant's soldiers had done a creditable job in suppressing mob violence. Having done that, Speed added, they have nothing to do with the redress of private grievances or prosecutions for public wrongs. This hands-off attitude was completely antithetical to the assertive use of federal power so strenuously expounded by Grant. In June, radical Republicans enacted the centerpiece of their legislative efforts to defend freed blacks, passing the 14th Amendment, which engraved in the Constitution the principle of equal citizenship before the law, regardless of race. It declared that all persons born or naturalized in the United States enjoyed both federal and state citizenship and prevented states from denying freedoms mandated by the Bill of Rights. Seeking to scotch the black codes, it denied states the right to deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and guaranteed all citizens equal protection of the laws. Andrew Johnson, who now gloried in taunting Congress, not only opposed the amendment but urged Southern states to reject it, which they did. Nevertheless, the 14th Amendment was ratified on July 9, 1868. During the growing tug-of-war between Congress and Johnson to curry favor with Grant, Johnson recommended and Congress passed on July 25th an act to create, especially for Grant, the new grade of General of the Army of the United States, with an annual salary of $20,000. As Mark Twain said, it gave Grant that supreme and stately and simple one-word title, General, placing an unprecedented 4 stars on his shoulder straps and making him the first person since George Washington to hold the full general title. In the reshuffling of military ranks that followed, Sherman became lieutenant general, while Rawlins retained his chief of staff post. Grant's elevation and the George Washington analogy inevitably spurred discussion about his possible ascent to the presidency. During the House debate, Thaddeus Stevens drew laughter when he volunteered his willingness to lift this Marlborough, this Wellington, to a higher office whenever the happy moment shall arrive. When Sherman told Grant that spreading disillusionment with politicians was leading to a popular groundswell for him as president, a move Sherman thought would harm his pure-hearted friend, Grant did his best to reassure him. All that I can say to discourage the idea of my ever being a candidate for an office, I do say. As a Democratic-leaning president and a Republican-dominated Congress vied for his favor, Grant tried to tiptoe modestly along the political tightrope suspended between them. Of course, the one person who claimed to read Grant's mind with telepathic clarity was his father. In a published letter, Jesse ruled out a near-term presidential run by his son. "You know, Ulysses is not and never was an aspirant for any personal favor or promotion. To accept the presidency would be to him a sacrifice of feeling and personal interest." At the same time, Jesse brashly opened the door for a future presidential race for his son, asserting that if there should seem to be the same necessity for it 2 years hence as now, I expect he will yield. This letter appeared in the New York Times on September 24, 1866, as Grant labored to spike such speculation. As he had long since learned, it was impossible to curb these eruptions from his self-important, busybody father. Political tensions flared on July 30th when racial violence broke out at a mostly black convention at the Mechanics Institute in New Orleans, convened to remodel the state constitution and secure black voting rights. Goaded by Mayor John Monroe, a Confederate pardoned by Johnson, the local press had published inflammatory stories about the gathering. Around 1 p.m., a procession of black delegates marched to the Institute, brandishing an American flag, when it clashed with a white mob backed by police, many of them Confederate veterans. The whites stomped, kicked, and clubbed the black marchers mercilessly. Policemen smashed the Institute's windows and fired into it indiscriminately until the floor grew slick with blood. When blacks inside shook a white flag from a window, the white policemen ignored it and invaded the building. They emptied their revolvers on the convention delegates, who desperately sought to escape. Some leapt from windows and were shot dead when they landed. Those lying wounded on the ground were stabbed repeatedly, their skulls bashed in with brickbats. The sadism was so wanton that men who kneeled and prayed for mercy were killed instantly, while dead bodies were stabbed and mutilated. Dr. Anthony Dosti, a well-known white Republican, was shot 5 times and slashed with a sword for good measure. Let Dosti's skin be forthwith stripped and sold to P.T. Barnum, the Mobile Tribune taunted, the proceeds to go to the Freedmen's Bureau and Negro newspapers. In the end, the riot left 34 blacks and 3 white Republicans dead, with 160 wounded, in a chilling display of racial hatred. The son of Hannibal Hamlin, Lincoln's first vice president, commented on the sickening butchery. "I have seen death on the battlefield, but time will erase the effects of that. The wholesale slaughter and the little regard paid to human life I witnessed here on the 30th of July, I shall never forget. This violence seemed a grotesque continuation of the Civil War by other means, and one member of the white rabble went so far as to brag, "We have fought for 4 years, these goddamned Yankees and sons of bitches in the field, and now we will fight them in the city." The melee had occurred in the military bailiwick of Phil Sheridan, who was in Texas at the time. At first, Sheridan branded the black delegates political agitators and revolutionary men, vowing to arrest them. Yet when he hurried back to New Orleans to investigate, he was revolted by the white mob's behavior, telling Grant how 200 blacks were attacked with firearms, clubs, and knives in a manner so unnecessary and atrocious as to compel me to say it was murder. The next day, Sheridan delivered a sterner indictment. It was no riot, it was an absolute massacre by the police, which was not excelled in murderous cruelty by that of Fort Pillow. This was provocative language, Fort Pillow having witnessed the most notorious slaughter of black soldiers during the war. On August 13th, after further probing, Sheridan wrote that, "I believe that at least 9/10 of the casualties were perpetrated by the police and citizens stabbing and smashing in the heads of many who had been already wounded or killed by policemen." Only the presence of federal troops restored order to the turbulent city. To Stanton, Grant recommended that New Orleans be kept under martial law until the causes of the riot are ascertained and the guilty parties brought to punishment, an action Stanton readily endorsed. After conferring with Johnson, Stanton informed Sheridan that he had full authority for the maintenance of the public peace and safety. It is important to note that such military rule by the North was not imposed lightly or capriciously, but in direct response to a total collapse of Southern justice in its treatment of defenseless blacks. As chief general at a time when the South gradually fell under military rule, Grant could not escape a central role, try though he might, to be neutral. As attention focused on which side he would choose, one worried Louisiana Republican lectured, "General Grant must be told not to listen to the cowardly dog, Andrew Johnson." It was already apparent that Grant's sympathies lay with the threatened black community and the need for a forceful military presence in the South. On August 6th, Sheridan sent the president a detailed account of the veritable orgy of sadism unleashed against blacks at the New Orleans Convention, which he saw as a turning point in the question of whether the South would respect the rule of law. "No steps have as yet been taken by the civil authorities to arrest citizens who were engaged in this massacre or policemen who perpetrated such cruelties," he reported a week after the violence. It was bootless to appeal to Andrew Johnson on this issue. Even before the riot, he had notified Louisiana's lieutenant governor that the black convention could be disrupted. Instead of blaming police for atrocities, he assailed the radical Congress and its misguided desire to enfranchise the colored population. In response, radical Republicans began to wonder darkly whether they would need to impeach the president. Reflecting their extreme apprehension, Thomas Nast published a scathing cartoon in which a grinning President Johnson stood in a doorway, watching as white men hacked to death a host of helpless black figures. In the wake of the New Orleans riot, Grant found President Johnson and his policies increasingly intolerable. On August 18, 1866, Johnson entertained at the White House a delegation from the National Union Convention in Philadelphia, his chosen vehicle for packing Congress with conservative supporters, and invited Grant. Although Abraham Lincoln ran under the National Union banner in 1864, its Republican membership had dwindled and it had settled solidly into the Democratic camp. "The gathering had acquired such a coppery hue," said one journalist, "that Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest, the perpetrator of the Fort Pillow massacre, was named a vice president." Profoundly unsettled by this summons to a baldly political event, Grant felt duty-bound to honor Johnson's request. Outwardly, it would appear, as Johnson clearly intended, that Grant was lending the event his prestige. Greeted by applause at his entrance, Grant strode up to Johnson and shook hands amid a round of cheers. To one reporter, Grant's behavior seemed to imply, "I am with your gentleman. I endorse your proceedings." Appearances could be grossly deceiving. An outraged Grant was persuaded that the president had selfishly manipulated him. As Badeau explained, Grant went to the White House with the intention of excusing himself, but the president had already taken his place in the East Room and sent for the general-in-chief to join him there. Again, Grant thought that without positive rudeness, he could not refuse. So he stood by Johnson's side during the entire demonstration, greatly to his own disgust and chagrin, and returned to his headquarters afterwards full of indignation and beginning to detest the policy of the president. Grant's relationship with Johnson soon worsened. Against the warnings of his advisers, the president planned a speaking tour of northern states, popularly dubbed a swing around the circle, to publicize his pro-Southern policies, berate congressional Republicans, and woo Democrats in the fall elections. The pretext for this three-week, 2,000-mile extravaganza was to dedicate a monument to the late Stephen A. Douglas in Chicago, but the whole thing soon smacked of crude political theater. Johnson dragooned Grant into joining the cavalcade, so it would seem as if Grant subscribed to his views. Repeatedly, Grant rebuffed Johnson's offer until the president grew so insistent that Grant felt it would be indecorous any longer to object, wrote Badeau. Many Americans believed Grant adhered to the president's policies when he actually detested Johnson's chicanery and was in reality doing more than all the country besides to thwart Johnson's designs. In addition to Grant, Admiral David Farragut, William Seward, Gideon Welles, and George Gordon Meade made up the retinue. On August 29th, the presidential caravan reached New York City, where large, boisterous crowds turned out. Preceded by his distinguished entourage, Johnson stood in an open carriage, bowing and playing melodramatically to the masses. When the group went for a drive in Central Park, Grant took the reins of his carriage and challenged another driver to a race, winning easily. Rawlins, who accompanied the tour, hoped it would fix Grant in the confidence of Mr. Johnson, enabling him to fix up the army as it should be. It soon grew apparent, however, that Grant and Farragut, not the president, received the bulk of applause, and newspapers gleefully recounted how Johnson writhed with envious embarrassment. "He becomes incensed at the repeated cheers for Grant," read one headline. "The people cry aloud for Grant and do not want to hear A.J.," said another. By August 31st, a disenchanted Grant wrote to Julia from Auburn, New York, hometown of William Seward. "I am getting very tired of this expedition and of hearing political speeches. I must go through, however." The visit was marred by a freakish incident. A young boy named Clarence Richardson was so eager to rush up and meet Grant that he slipped under a carriage, crushing his leg. Once Grant learned of this, he went to console the boy. Later on, he was devastated when he heard his leg had been amputated and promptly wrote to him, "How sad now to hear that you have suffered amputation, and then, too, that I should have been innocently the cause of this mishap." Grant kept in touch with Clarence, swapping photographs with him. As the tour wound through Midwestern cities, it degenerated into a public relations nightmare for the president, showcasing the coarse, vulgar side of his nature. Some observers thought he was frequently drunk, and Senator John Sherman snickered that the trip had sunk the presidential office to the level of a grog house. When angry crowds heckled him, the boorish Johnson lashed out in return. As Johnson aired his disgust with radical Republicans and expressed disdain for blacks, Grant, feeling mortified and exploited, attempted to shrink into the background. Running into his old friend Daniel Ammen, he openly declared his disgust with the tour. "Perhaps on no other occasion save this one have I seen General Grant discomposed," Ammen commented. To a reporter, Grant complained that he didn't consider the army a place for a politician. To another, he grumbled that, "I am disgusted at hearing a man make speeches on the way to his own funeral." Since the war, Grant had steered clear of the bottle, but the trip so unnerved him that en route from Buffalo to Cleveland, he began to indulge with Surgeon General Joseph Barnes, who had attended to Abraham Lincoln on his deathbed. His omnipresent watchdog, Julia, was absent, but even Rawlins, part of the retinue, could not stave off the binge, underscoring Grant's extreme distress. According to Sylvanus Cadwallader, the Cleveland reception committee on the train had a refreshment car loaded with eatables and potables, and waiters passed constantly through the cars, plying everybody to eat and drink. General Grant had to be taken into a baggage car, compelled to lie down on a pile of empty sacks and rubbish, and remain there till we reached Cleveland. General Rawlins and myself stood guard over him, alternately, every mile of the way, locked out all callers for him, and protected him from observation as far as possible. This sounds exaggerated. Cadwallader had embellished the Satartia story, until we note that Postmaster General Alexander Randall claimed to see Surgeon General Barnes go up to Grant to feel his pulse, only to find Barnes so drunk that he tumbled down on him. Gideon Wells confirmed that Grant had grown garrulous and stupidly communicative on the way to Cleveland. The episode fits Grant's pattern of drinking on visits to distant cities, far from the critical eyes of his staff and wife, and it was one of the last times it happened. On September 3rd, an especially hostile audience baited Johnson in Cleveland, where his behavior flirted with new lows. When a heckler yelled that Johnson should hang Jeff Davis, the president rejoined, "Why not hang Thad Stevens and Wendell Phillips?" When someone in the crowd hollered, "Is this dignified?" Johnson shot back, "I care not for dignity." Wells said Grant was somewhat inebriated in Cleveland, and Johnson explained that he was extremely ill. To hide their drunken binge, Grant and Barnes were smuggled aboard a steamer bound for Detroit, both of them intoxicated, noted Wells, in the hope that the bracing Lake Erie air might sober them up. Writing to Julia from Detroit, Grant admitted that, for an unspecified reason, he had broken away from the tour. General Rawlins, Dr. Barnes, and myself switched off from the party at Cleveland last night and came here by boat. The balance of the party stayed overnight there and will reach here this evening. On September 9th, the tour touched its nadir in St. Louis, when Johnson, in another intemperate outburst, had the gall to blame Congress for the New Orleans riot. "Every drop of blood that was shed is upon their skirts, and they are responsible for it." Turning himself into a martyr, he proclaimed, "I have been traduced, I have been slandered, I have been maligned, I have been called Judas Iscariot." To Julia, Grant transmitted his horrified reaction. "I never have been so tired of anything before as I have been with the political stump speeches of Mr. Johnson. I look upon them as a national disgrace." Even many northern papers that had supported his presidency turned against him, believing he had demeaned the office with these scurrilous screeds. Contrary to Johnson's plan to promote himself, the tour provoked a spontaneous boom for a Grant presidency. In Newark, Ohio, spectators interrupted Johnson's speech with calls for Grant. "You cannot insult the president through General Grant," George Armstrong Custer chastised them. However much Grant abhorred Johnson's behavior, he refused to countenance actions that presented him as a presidential hopeful and asserted he would never allow the American military to be made a party machine. When a Chicago crowd gathered outside his train to further his candidacy, Grant refused to encourage the demonstration or even leave his car. In Cincinnati, Grant arrived earlier than Johnson and was enjoying a theater outing when a military company showed up wanting to support him and dump Johnson. Taciturn on the tour, Grant abruptly found his tongue, lecturing the group's leader. Sir, I am no politician. The President of the United States is my commander-in-chief. I consider this demonstration in opposition to the President of the United States, Andrew Johnson. If you have any regard for me, you will take your men away. The next day, Grant may have regretted such misplaced loyalty when the President had a well-known St. Louis copperhead, Congressman John Hogan, introduce him to various crowds, a gaffe the victor of Appomattox simply couldn't abide. Grant told Wells he had no desire to associate with the man. A rebel he could forgive, but not a copperhead. Pleading ill health, Grant departed from the tour and returned early to Washington. Compared with Johnson, he seemed the soul of sanity, and thus benefited politically from the trip, even if he had not sought that outcome. As Badeau reported, people have talked to us of Grant being made dictator, and at any rate makes it more certain that nobody else can be next president, which for him is not a consummation devoutly to be wished for. Johnson confided to Secretary of the Interior Orville Browning that Grant connived for the presidency and that there was a conspiracy on foot among the radicals to incite another rebellion and especially to arm and exasperate the Negroes in the South. Some Washington observers floated scenarios of a constitutional showdown in which Johnson would deploy Grant and the military to silence Congress. Suddenly, Grant's political tendencies became of more than theoretical interest. Ben Butler, now a radical Republican, wondered privately whether Grant can be trusted to disobey positive orders of his chief. When the hour of peril comes, shall we not be leaning on a broken reed? Grant knew of this high-stakes guessing game. No matter how close I keep my tongue, he informed Sherman, both parties try to interpret from the little let drop that I am with them. He was so dismayed that he wanted to yield his command and travel abroad, but felt obligated to stay home at such a perilous moment for the nation. On September 22nd, Grant performed an act that spoke volumes about his secret sympathies. He quietly ordered the Chief of Ordnance, General Alexander Dyer, to empty surplus weapons from 5 Southern arsenals and send most of their small arms to New York Harbor. He also spurned a request from Virginia to furnish 10,000 weapons for white militias to confront a supposedly better-armed black population. In addition, he opposed rearming former Confederate states. Writing confidentially to Sheridan, Grant warned that few people who fought for the North exerted any influence over the pro-Southern president. Johnson, he feared, would declare Congress as a body illegal, unconstitutional, and revolutionary. Commanders in Southern states will have to take great care to see, if a crisis does come, that no armed headway can be made against the Union. The outside world may have wondered about Grant's sympathies, but his private statements leave no room for conjecture about his inexorable drift toward radical republicanism. Wells later speculated that by fall 1866, Grant was secretly acting in concert with the radicals to deceive and beguile the president. Grant didn't regard it as deception so much as adhering to bedrock principles, telling Badeau he had never felt so anxious about the country. As it happened, Grant swam in a strong political tide. Johnson's swing around the circle was such an indescribable fiasco that Republicans registered stunning gains in the fall elections, winning substantial majorities in both houses of Congress. The election also resoundingly endorsed the 14th Amendment. These electoral gains prompted speculation about whether Johnson would seek by force to block the new Congress from meeting. Taking advantage of their election mandate, radical Republicans planned to initiate a period of congressional reconstruction, helping blacks and white Republicans in the South and supplanting presidential reconstruction with its heavy bias towards Southern white Democrats. Rawlins was upset by talk that Grant might be seduced by radical Republicans, and not only because he was more conservative than his boss. Like Sherman, he believed Grant was not a politician or statesman, but only a man who knew how to fight well. For Rawlins, Grant was not a man of ability outside of the profession of arms, and was a man of strong passions and intense prejudices. Rawlins thought Sherman a great man, a statesman as well as a soldier. Grant was the soldier only. The fraternal protectiveness Rawlins had shown toward Grant's drinking now extended to what he deemed the equally corrupting influence of politics. By February 1866, Napoleon III announced plans to withdraw troops from Mexico, an apparent victory for the diplomatic approach advocated by Seward versus Grant's more robust desire to go to war. On the other hand, Grant's decision to send a military force to the Rio Grande had helped the liberal opposition there to survive. Grant's worries about Mexico as a haven for renegade rebels hadn't abated, especially after Sheridan warned in February that if the scheme is not broken up, every act of our government which is distasteful to these people will cause a fresh exodus to Mexico. For Grant, Mexico was a hotly emotional topic. Unpersuaded that Napoleon III would budge, Grant badgered President Johnson to supply arms to liberal forces in Mexico to rid the country of the French-imposed emperor, assuring a reporter that Sheridan, with 2,000 American troops, would clean Maximilian out of Mexico in 6 months. On October 18th, at the president's behest, Grant sent a cryptic letter to Sherman in St. Louis, asking him to come to Washington and intimating he might be named acting Secretary of War. Like Rawlins, Sherman saw Washington as a cockpit of intrigue and preferred to steer clear of it. Grant couldn't say so in a letter, but he had experienced growing friction with Johnson, who feared that in a constitutional confrontation with Congress, Grant would lean toward the legislature. Hence, Johnson wanted to ease Grant out of town, sending him on a diplomatic mission to Mexico. Grant was supposed to escort the new American minister to Mexico, Lewis D. Campbell of Ohio, and meet with Benito Juarez. Campbell had a well-known fondness for drink, and some thought Johnson wished to expose Grant to temptation and tarnish his reputation. Of this unwanted assignment, Grant told the president flatly, "It is a diplomatic service for which I am not fitted either by education or taste." Grant believed he would be damaged by a failed Mexican mission, while Seward would take credit for a successful one. He also believed Johnson had no right to send a military man on a patently political trip. When Sherman reached Washington, Grant told him that he had thought the matter over, would disobey the order, and stand the consequences. In emotional tones, he characterized the order as a plot to get rid of him. Backing Grant fully, Sherman marched off to see the president, who received him cordially and said he wished him to command the army in Grant's absence in Mexico. "I then informed him that General Grant would not go," Sherman recalled, and he seemed amazed. Sherman pointed out that Hancock in New Mexico or Sheridan in Texas could easily handle the job, and if neither was satisfactory, he would gladly go himself. "Certainly," said the president. "If you will go, that will answer perfectly." Sherman saw Johnson manipulating Grant as a mere pawn in a power play. "I have no doubt there is some plan to get Grant out of the way and to get me here, but I will be a party to no such move," Sherman informed his wife. He suspected the president harassed Grant because he was looming up as a candidate for president. Badeau also thought Johnson meditated replacing Grant with the more conservative Sherman, who would be more supple in supporting his Reconstruction policies. Even though the importunate Johnson hectored Grant to take the job, he remained unyielding. He then invited Grant to a cabinet meeting at which he exploded with rage when Grant declined the Mexican mission. According to Julia, the president raised his voice and struck the table with his clenched hand with considerable force. Johnson asked the attorney general whether any reason existed why General Grant should not obey my orders. Is he in any way ineligible to this position? Grant sprang to his feet in protest. "I am an officer of the army and bound to obey your military orders. But this is a civil office, a purely diplomatic duty that you offer me, and I cannot be compelled to undertake it." Amid shocked silence, Grant stormed from the room. Realizing that he was unmovable, Johnson reluctantly let Sherman go to Mexico instead. The president could no longer doubt Grant's opposition. Grant was as anxious to frustrate Johnson's maneuvers as he had ever been to thwart those of Lee, wrote Badeau. In the end, William Seward was correct that Maximilian's empire rested on shaky turf, and that patient diplomacy in Mexico worked better than force. In June 1867, liberal forces loyal to Benito Juarez executed Maximilian by a firing squad in a move applauded by Grant. Johnson did everything in his power to dissuade Southern states from accepting the 14th Amendment. Unlike the president, Grant believed they should adopt it before readmission to the Union, and grew progressively more alarmed that black and white Republicans were being murdered with abandon in Southern states. On January 18, 1867, he wrote a confidential letter to Oliver O. Howard that showed what a flaming militant he had become in protecting freedmen and how closely he now identified with radical Republicans. Grant asked Howard to compile a list of authenticated cases of murder committed against freed people and white Republicans in the South during the previous 6 months. "My object in this is to make a report showing that the courts in the states excluded from Congress afford no security to life or property, and to recommend that martial law be declared over such districts as do not afford the proper protection." On February 8th, Grant handed Howard's findings to Stanton. In a cabinet discussion a week later, Howard's evidence was gruffly dismissed by Wells as mere rumors of Negro murders, unworthy of serious consideration. This would become a standard Democratic defense in future years. Johnson and Wells worked to bury the explosive document. If it went to Congress, Wells feared, certain mischievous persons would say that here was information of which Grant complained, but of which the president took no notice. All the while, a movement to impeach the president gathered strength in Republican circles. Since people imagined Johnson might be suspended from his official duties before being convicted, the conflict portended a crisis of the first magnitude. By now, Johnson had surrendered any lingering solicitude for poor Southern whites in favor of the old slaveholding elite, making the former slaves the villains of his administration. When the journalist Charles Nordoff met him at the White House, he described the president as sure that the people of the South were to be trodden underfoot to protect niggers. Grant believed that Johnson strove to form a coalition of Northern peace Democrats and former Confederates to nullify the war's outcome. So plausible did it seem that the conflict between Johnson and Congress would end in violence that Congressman John Logan of Illinois wrote discreetly to Colonel N.P. Chipman in the War Department, warning him to quietly and secretly organize all our boys that can assemble at a given signal, ready to protect the Congress of the U.S. For many in Washington, the great mystery was how Grant would act in such a crisis. "President Johnson didn't know the answer," wrote Gideon Wells, "and I doubt if Grant himself knows. The radicals, who distrust him, are nevertheless courting him assiduously." The radicals succeeded in attracting him to their camp, for only they could offer continuity with the deeply held values that had informed his wartime service. Alarmed by the punishment being inflicted on former slaves and Union men in the South, Grant recommended to Stanton on January 29, 1867, that Texas be placed under martial law. Such a measure, he thought, would be a warning to other Southern states, and if necessary, could be extended to others. A few weeks later, the New York Times printed a candid interview in which Grant chided Southern states for their recalcitrance. "If they had accepted the 14th Amendment instead of rejecting it so hastily, they would have been admitted by Congress in December. But now I think they will have to take the amendment and manhood suffrage besides." In many parts of Texas, Grant asserted, A Union man wasn't safe outside the umbrella of federal military protection. When asked whether a Union man could travel safely in the South, he replied frankly that if he got into angry political discussions, there would be danger in some places, no doubt. In that case, shooting would probably be passed off as justifiable homicide if the murderer was arrested at all. On March 2, 1867, the Radical Republicans, having scored stunning gains in the fall elections, engineered a backlash against Andrew Johnson that crystallized with passage of what became known as the First Reconstruction Act. In shaping the bill, Congress consulted closely with Grant. The legislation carved up 10 Confederate states, Tennessee, having ratified the 14th Amendment, was exempt, into 5 military districts. Appointed by the president, the general commanding each district would exercise enormous power, overseeing conventions to draft new constitutions before their states were readmitted to the Union. States were required to ratify the 14th Amendment and grant voting rights to black men. Betraying his ingrained racial prejudice, Johnson vetoed the act. "The Negroes have not asked for the privilege of voting," he stated, "and the vast majority of them have no idea what it means." Grant scorned this message as ridiculous, and large House and Senate majorities quickly overrode the veto. Johnson deferred to Grant's wishes in picking the first 5 military district commanders, John Schofield, Dan Sickles, George Thomas, Edward Ord, and Phil Sheridan, although Gideon Welles griped that in choosing these men, Grant had been swayed by radical influence. The First Reconstruction Act represented an extraordinary effort to invest former slaves with full citizenship rights, delivering a stark rebuke to Southern whites who wanted to hurl them back into a new form of bondage. "What a bitter dose for their arrogant aristocracy of only 7 years ago," George Templeton Strong gloated. "Was there ever a more tremendous and searching social revolution?" For many Southern whites, it seemed that, having endured wartime defeat, they now had to submit to a second military humiliation. Summarizing this view decades later, H.L. Mencken claimed the South was subjected to the supervision and veto of the rest of the country and enjoyed scarcely more liberty in the political sense than so many convicts in the penitentiary. Yet for Southern blacks and white Republicans, the First Reconstruction Act promised sorely needed protection against the indiscriminate white terror directed at them with alarming frequency. Privately, Grant endorsed the legislation as a fitting end to all our controversy. Southern intolerance, as revealed by the Memphis and New Orleans race riots, had led him to revise his lenient attitude at Appomattox in favor of more drastic measures to protect freed people. "General Grant getting more and more radical," Comstock noted in his diary. With military oversight of the South and district commanders reporting directly to him, Grant now wielded unprecedented power over the region, probably more domestic power than any other general-in-chief in American history. In enforcing the new legislation, he increasingly took his cues from Congress and bypassed an intransigent president. Still a relative novice in Washington politics, Grant managed at first to maintain decent relations with both Johnson and Congress, Welles speculating that he would not be surprised if Grant, in whom Johnson still has great confidence, and possibly Stanton, are the only persons whom he consults. Grant performed a nimble balancing act that would be tested as strains between the president and Congress grew unmanageable. On the day the Reconstruction Bill passed, Congress also enacted the Tenure of Office Act, a future flashpoint in its relations with the president. From the earliest days of the Republic, presidents had been obligated to seek the advice and consent of the Senate in appointing cabinet members, while retaining full power to remove them. Radical Republicans feared Johnson would seek to eviscerate Reconstruction by ousting Stanton, and the new bill, specifically designed to protect him, required Senate approval before firing cabinet members. With some justice, Johnson saw the law as impinging squarely on his constitutional prerogatives. After objections from congressional moderates, The bill was modified to apply only to cabinet members appointed by sitting presidents, exempting those appointed by previous presidents. Since Stanton had been named by Lincoln, the tantalizing question hung fire. Was he covered by the act? As president, Grant would acknowledge the law's absurdity and work to repeal it. When it became the law of the land in 1867, however, he felt legally bound to obey it. Congress imposed other punitive restraints on the president. A rider to a military appropriation bill prevented him from issuing orders directly to the army, lest he tamper with radical Reconstruction and pressure Southern commanders. All such orders had to be routed through Grant, lodging extra power in his hands. The rider further stipulated that Grant could be cashiered only with Senate consent. Taken together, these rules chipped away at Johnson's power and converted Grant and Stanton into protected wards of Congress, presaging a constitutional showdown between Johnson and radical Republicans that would hinge on the political sympathies of the two men. Of the five military commanders in the South, none supported congressional Reconstruction more militantly than Sheridan, who was in charge of Louisiana and Texas, and especially bewailed conditions in Louisiana. "Government is denounced. The freedmen are shot, and Union men are persecuted if they have the temerity to express their opinion." Within a week of his appointment, Sheridan showed how briskly he would enforce the first Reconstruction Act by removing from office the Louisiana Attorney General, the New Orleans mayor, and a federal district judge in the city, all of whom had condoned recent racial violence. He believed they had egged on the rioters, then prosecuted victims instead of perpetrators. 2 days later, Grant applauded Sheridan's action. "I have just seen your order. It is just the thing, and meets the universal approbation of the loyal people, at least." When Sheridan contemplated removing the Texas and Louisiana governors, Grant cautioned him against doing so, saying its constitutionality was questionable. Never cavalier about constitutional issues, Grant believed the first Reconstruction Act provided military governments for the rebel states until they were fully restored in all their relations to the general government. Until then, military commanders should regard present state governments as provisional, tolerating them just so far as they could be used in carrying out the will of Congress. On March 23rd, the Second Reconstruction Act expanded the powers of district commanders over Southern election procedures and allowed them to register voters, a move that enraged Andrew Johnson, who blocked further removal of Southern officials by the military in early April. Although Grant sent this order to Sheridan, he secretly dissented from it, informing Sheridan, "There is a decided hostility to the whole congressional plan for Reconstruction at the White House, and a disposition to remove you from the command you now have. Both the Secretary of War and myself will oppose any such move, as will the mass of the people." Far from seeing himself as high-handed or dictatorial, Grant pictured himself as a soldier loyally carrying out congressional directives. By virtue of his position, Grant received panoramic accounts of conditions in the South that portrayed a region seething with white hatred, and sometimes black as well. In mid-April, he dispatched Orville Babcock and Horace Porter to report on Southern Reconstruction. The two men gave an optimistic verdict on the progress of blacks who had embraced citizenship with an enthusiasm that heartened Northern abolitionists and terrified white supremacists. As Babcock wrote from New Orleans, "The Negro is learning very fast. They will soon be the best educated class in the South, if they continue at their present rate of progress." The Freedmen's Bureau had helped to sign up 130,735 students in classes, but teachers, white and black, continued to be murdered and burned out of schools and homes. Babcock and Porter witnessed an ominous upsurge of Confederate sentiment, with Confederate symbols employed to intimidate blacks. "In Georgia," wrote Babcock, "the police in most of the cities are in a gray uniform, the real Confederate uniform." Certain states resisted Reconstruction more passionately than others. After visiting three Texas cities, Porter wrote, "This is by far the worst state in the Union, and it is only by the adoption of strict and decided measures that it is kept from giving a great deal of trouble. Anti-black animus in the South now assumed more sinister forms. In mid-1866, Confederate veterans in Pulaski, Tennessee, founded a club called the Ku Klux Klan. Its arcane name derived from the Greek word kuklos for band or circle. By the time of the first Reconstruction Act, what had started out as a social club began to shade into a quasi-military organization, recruiting Nathan Bedford Forrest as a leader. It was less a tightly structured organization than a free-floating network of thuggish white groups adopting similar methods and rituals to terrorize blacks. Members vowed to support a white man's government and carry weapons at all times. Before long, former privates in the Confederate Army were taking orders from their old officers in the Klan. To hide their identities, Klansmen donned outlandish hoods to terrorize their former slaves into believing they represented the ghosts of dead Confederate soldiers. They carried out murders and mutilations in a grotesque spirit of sadistic mockery. Despite these disguises, the freedmen often knew and feared the identities of their tormentors. By no coincidence, the Klan would spread rapidly across the South during the 1868 elections, targeting, as it did, black voters. The actions taken by Sheridan were detested by the Klan. He ordered mayors in Louisiana and Texas to draw at least half their police officers from former Union soldiers, meaning black veterans would be hired. He also presided over a budding civil rights revolution, starting with the desegregation of New Orleans streetcars. Previously, blacks had been forced to ride on separate streetcars with stars stamped on their sides. When they crowded onto white streetcars in protest, transport companies appealed to Sheridan to banish these black passengers. Instead, Sheridan warned that if companies permitted discrimination, he would bar them from the streets. Sheridan informed Grant that once the original hubbub over desegregated streetcars subsided, the locals had cheerfully adopted the new system, and the excitement died out at once. This startling early revolution in civil rights would be all but forgotten by later generations of Americans. Never a man for halfway measures, Sheridan in early June removed Governor James M. Wells of Louisiana, who had brazenly defied Reconstruction. In typically hot-blooded language, Sheridan blasted Wells as a political trickster and a dishonest man, whose conduct has been as sinuous as the mark left in the dust by the movement of a snake. Many people concurred. The New Orleans Times quipped that all's well that ends well's. But the action remained highly controversial. Sheridan believed that if civil officers could flout military commanders with impunity, Reconstruction was bound to fail. Writing to him in confidence, Grant emphasized that Stanton supported the Wells removal, while he himself rendered a more qualified judgment. "I have no doubt myself but that the removal of Governor Wells will do great good in your command if you are sustained, but great harm if you are not sustained." Already irate with Sheridan, Johnson reprimanded him and told him to defer his action. Bent upon foiling the congressional reconstruction pushed by radical Republicans, he elicited from Attorney General Henry Stanbury an opinion that flagrantly challenged the policy, alleging that military commanders should refrain from suspending political officials. This provoked a bruising cabinet battle, with Stanton hotly denouncing this crabbed interpretation of the law. When Johnson ordered Grant to circulate Stanbury's opinion to district commanders, Grant betrayed his true sympathies by letting them know they could freely interpret it as they chose. Although Grant was usually dutiful in following civilian policy, he believed Johnson had subverted the will of Congress in a way that bordered on treason. It grated on Johnson that Grant, a mere subordinate, had been endowed with such godlike powers over Reconstruction. By this point, there was no magical way to balance ambitious Reconstruction policies mandated by Congress with the obstructive arts of a hostile president. On June 27th, Wells reported a nervous and apprehensive Johnson living in constant dread of impeachment. However much he disagreed with the president, Grant prayed this extreme remedy would be averted unless something occurs hereafter to fully justify it. While radical Republicans were ready to banish the hated president, party moderates remained skittish about forcing him from office. On July 18th, Grant testified before the House Judiciary Committee, which had begun to consider possible impeachment, and he contrasted his humane treatment of Lee and other paroled officers with the harsh action favored by Johnson, who thought they should be tried and punished, and treason made odious. He reiterated his long-standing contention that Lee wouldn't have surrendered had he believed he was going to be tried for treason and hanged. Grant was honest without being vindictive toward Johnson, and won plaudits from the press. The responsibility, the fidelity, the sagacity of General Grant constitute the only guarantee for the adequate enforcement of the conditions dictated by Congress in the spirit in which they were conceived, wrote the New York Times. The day after Grant testified, Congress approved the Third Reconstruction Act, which confirmed the power of district commanders to fire civilian officials and expanded their supreme power over voting rights. When Johnson vetoed the bill, Congress promptly overrode it. Though the legislature adjourned the next day, a committee lingered in the Capitol to take testimony that might yield grounds for impeachment. Instead of focusing on Reconstruction, the true issue, they chose a more roundabout method, hoping to find Johnson guilty of improper conduct. Specifically, they hoped to prove he had corresponded with Confederate politicians, misappropriated federal funds, and chosen unqualified figures to govern Southern states. Stymied in his bid to hobble congressional Reconstruction, Andrew Johnson was especially enraged by his belief that Edwin Stanton had authored the new Reconstruction bill. Armed with the new powers, Grant took strong measures to deal with looming racial strife in Memphis. Nothing alarmed the white South more than black power at the polls, which was why most terror was directed there. Stanton had received warnings of a formidable and bloody riot in Memphis, scheduled for its August 1st election, to prevent Negroes voting. Grant didn't care to wait until people are killed and the mob beyond control, and sent troops in advance of the election. After his testimony, Grant felt badly in need of a breather from the poisonous atmosphere of Washington. For the first time, he and Julia took a seaside cottage in Long Branch, New Jersey, a hideaway where Grant could revert to a life that suited him more. The town had recently become a fashionable watering hole for millionaires. The waterfront house on Ocean Avenue was 3 stories high, with a shingled roof and 2 glassed-in observatories. Twice a day, Grant rode in a carriage to breathe in tangy salt air before returning to the house and poring over mail and newspapers on the veranda. Staying in Long Branch struck him as a guilty pleasure. "Every day that I am absent from Washington," he informed Stanton, "I see something in the papers or hear something that makes me feel that I should be there." At the same time, he admitted wistfully that, "I have got so tired of being tied down that I am nearly ready to desert." Grant had many things to ponder about his future, since second-guessing his presidential aspirations had become a popular parlor game. With the benefit of hindsight, Andrew Johnson said Grant had supported him for 2 years, then saw the radical handwriting on the wall and heeded it. Grant did the proper thing to save Grant, but it pretty nearly ruined me. Grant was outwardly a sphinx upon whom people could project their preferred ideology, and radical Republicans searched for assurances that Grant stood on their side. With a select group of people, he was frank about his views, but never in public. People knew he had cast his lone vote for president for James Buchanan and still wondered whether he was a Republican or a Democrat. But for Grant, the Democrats had nothing to offer him, only a repudiation of the war and all its sacred goals. To unravel the mystery of his political affiliation, radical Republicans dispatched Senator Benjamin Wade to Covington to quiz Jesse Root Grant about his son's politics. Jesse and Hannah were out of town, and Michael John Kramer, Grant's brother-in-law, received the senator instead. Once seated in the parlor, Wade pressed Kramer for Grant's views on Reconstruction, saying he wished to know whether Grant was a good Republican, for we desire to bring him forward as our candidate for the presidency, yet we do not exactly know where he stands on these questions. When Kramer replied that Grant was a thorough Republican who could be fully trusted, Wade twirled his hat into the air and accidentally smashed a chandelier, then proclaimed, "That settles the matter. We shall propose Grant as the candidate for the Republican Party for the presidency. I am greatly relieved. With him, we are sure to win." For those seeking clues to Grant's political opinions, there was no surer source than a speech on Reconstruction delivered in Galena that June by John Rawlins. Knowing people saw Rawlins as his surrogate, Grant reviewed the speech carefully and gave it his private imprimatur. The speech was so detailed and corresponded so perfectly with the radical Republican agenda that it was widely reprinted. Rawlins said it made no sense to emancipate slaves if they weren't entitled to the law's full protection. Because Southern governments failed to adapt their constitutions to new political realities, Congress had a duty to sweep from existence any and all governments in any states that were anti-Republican. He applauded Congress for barring former Confederate states that hadn't guaranteed suffrage to all without distinction of race or color. Only through voting could freed people protect their liberties. In a rousing peroration, Rawlins described radical Reconstruction as the result of a wise exercise of the unquestionable power of the lawmaking branch of the government. The South must accept the situation fully and unreservedly. That Grant allowed Rawlins to make this fervent speech removed any residual doubt as to where he stood on the cardinal issue of the day.